Now, there are many different ways you can look at quantum computation and its goals, but since I'm a computer scientist, I will take the objective of a computer scientist. So if you're a computer scientist, then I think you will agree that the main question to ask about quantum computing is which problems admit a quantum speedup. Where I mean speedup in a fairly general sense, I mean it could be that you save time, it could be that you save communication, it could be that you save runs, as in the John's talk before the break. Now a question equivalent to this, a question equivalent to the question which problems admit a speedup, is the question which problems don't. Now in order to answer that question, we need to be able to show some limitations on quantum computers. We need to show for this and this problem, quantum computers give you nothing extra compared to classical computers. And so my talk will be basically a survey of some of the main lower bounds that are known for quantum computing. Here's a brief overview of the talk. So the lower bounds that I will show to you are lower bounds in the black box model of computation. I will come to that in a minute. After introducing the model, I will briefly discuss some early lower bounds work that was done in the early 90s. And after that, I will survey what I think are the two main generally applicable methods for lower bounds on quantum computation in the black box model. And that's the polynomial method and the quantum adversary method. After that, if I have time, I will also briefly survey what's known about the quantum complexities of searching and sorting, because I think searching and sorting are among the most basic and most important computer science problems. And I will conclude with a list of open problems related to lower bound research. Okay, let me first introduce the black box model and then try to say why it's interesting. Now, you probably remember from some of the earlier lectures that a lot of the current quantum computing algorithms work with queries. So the query complexity or black box model of computation is the following. We want to compute some function f on capital N bits. Now, something which might be a little bit confusing is that various speakers during this week use different notation for black box model. In particular, sometimes people use this letter F here for the specification of the inputs. I'm not doing that. So in my setting, F will denote the problem that you want to solve, the thing that you want to compute. So the thing that we want to compute is some function F, which acts on capital N input bits and outputs one bit. Without loss of generality, we can assume the output is just one bit because everything else just can be decomposed into Boolean functions. And now in this black box model of computation, we assume that this input, this n-bit vector, can only be accessed via queries. So a query is basically, someone gives you a black box, and it is indeed a black box. You have no idea what's in it. You input some number I, ranging from 1 up to capital N, and out comes the ith bit of the input. And one application of this black box will be called one query. And for computer scientists, you may want to think about this as just a random access memory. You can access any bit I of the input in one step, basically. Now, since we're dealing with quantum computers here, we will have to formalize this black box thing as a unitary transformation. And there's a standard agreed upon way to do that, which is basically you formalize this black box here as a unitary transformation O, which does the following. On input state I comma 0, it outputs or it transforms the state into the state I comma xi. So this number I here is log n qubits, giving a number between 1 and capital N. And this xi is just one bit. And because we want this thing to be reversible and unitary, we also have to specify what it does, the way it acts on I comma 1 basis states. And for those, it just puts the negation of the ith bit in the last qubit. So this number I here will be called the index, and the qubits corresponding to it will be called the index register, and the last qubit will be called the output because it corresponds to the output of the black box. That's where the bit xi goes. By the way, I'm using the letter O here because people sometimes call this thing an oracle. That's where the O comes from. So whenever I use words like black box or query or oracle, it all means the same thing. It means an application of this unitary transformation O. Now, a good thing about quantum computers is that whereas a classical computer can just input one specific I at a time in this black box, so access one bit at a time, a quantum computer can actually query a whole superposition of I's. So if you have a uniform superposition over all I's running from 1 up to n with output bit 0, and you apply this oracle or black box or query O to it, then by linearity, after this one application of the black box, you will have all of the bits xi in superposition in your output bit. Of course, this is not as strong as it seems initially. We will need to do something more with this in order to get a quantum speed up. But this is at least a very interesting ability of quantum computers to query all the bits at the same time in one go. And the objective of the model of black box computation is to compute this function f here using as few queries as we can, so to minimize the number of applications of O. It's probably good now to give an illustration or example of a quantum black box algorithm. So I will briefly explain the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. I think this has been run by you at least twice earlier this week, but some repetition won't hurt. So the Deutsch-Jose problem is the following. We have this capital N bit input. We assume for notational convenience that capital N is a power of 2, so it's 2 to the little n. And someone promises us that this input, this N bit vector here, satisfies one of two properties. Either all of the bits are 0, which we will call the constant case for obvious reasons, or exactly half of the bits are 0, and then the other half must be 1. And this we will call the balanced case because the number of zeros and the number of ones in the inputs balance. They're the same. Now let's briefly consider how many queries a classical algorithm would need to find out whether we're in case 1 or 2. Well, suppose it has queried, say, half of the inputs, capital N divided by 2 of the positions. And suppose the classical algorithm has seen only zeros. All of the N over 2 bits that it has queried are 0. Well, in that case, the output value is still undecided. I mean, it's still consistent that the remainder of the input is also 0, in which case we would be in a constant case. But it's also possible that the N over 2 bits that you haven't queried are all 1, in which case we would be in the balanced case. So this implies that classically you need at least N over 2 plus 1 queries in order to decide if you're in the constant or the balanced case. Well, the Deutsch-Jose algorithm solves the same problem with only one query. And of course, it will be a query in superposition. So in terms of the number of queries required, this is really a very good and strong separation, one versus half of the input length. Well, this is basically the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. There are little n qubits here. All of them are initially 0, so I've drawn only 2 of them, but you should consider that there are actually little n of them. And there's one n plus first qubit, which starts out in a 1 position. Now, to all of those, you apply a Hadamard transform. So to each qubit individually, you apply a Hadamard transform. Then you apply this one query. Then to the first n qubits, little n qubits, you apply another Hadamard transform, and then you measure. And this will give you the answer with certainty. This is going to tell you with certainty whether the input was constant or balanced. If you don't believe me, then I will prove it to you just by going through the algorithm. Well, maybe I should put it on this projector now so that I can refer to it. Oh, of course, I have only one projector. Right. Excuse me. Well, then you just have to memorize the Deutsch-Jose algorithm. So it's basically start out in a 0-1 state, apply a bunch of Hadamards, apply a query, apply a bunch of Hadamards, and measure. So let's see what happens. Well, after the first Hadamard transform, the first little n 0 qubits will be turned into a uniform superposition of all of the i's, all of the capital N i's. I guess you've seen this many times before, so I will not spend much time on it. The last qubit, which was initially 1, will be turned into this state by the Hadamard transform. And the reason to have the 0 minus 1 state here is that we can get the bit value xi in the face after the query. I guess you've also seen this sometimes before, so I'm not going to explain it. In any case, after the query, what's going to happen is that each of the xi's will appear in the exponent of minus 1 in front of the corresponding basis vector. So the only thing that the query does is it puts a minus 1 in front of I in case the xi bit was 1. And that's the only thing that happens. Now we apply the second batch of Hadamards. I'm going to ignore the last qubit now because it's not relevant anymore. The only reason to have it was to get the bit information in the phase instead of in the output qubit. So after the second Hadamard, this thing here transforms into this thing, where I dot d just means the inner product of the bit vectors I and j. This has also appeared several times earlier in the week. Now this thing here looks pretty ugly because there's a double sum involved, a sum over I and a sum over j. But if you evaluate it, in particular if you look at what the amplitude is for the state 0, so j equals 0, then it's actually very simple. So if you look at the j equals 0 case, then this minus 1 to the inner product ij just becomes 1 because the inner product of any string I with the 0 state will be 0. So this thing here drops out if you only look at the 0 state. These two 1 over square roots of n's can be combined into 1 over 2 to the n. And eventually, the main thing that happens is that all of these things here get summed. So if you only look at j equals 0, then this is the amplitude that you're going to get. Now notice that if every xi bit was 0, so if we're in the constant case, then all of these guys here will be 1. Since you're summing over 2 to the n of those, and you're dividing by 2 to the n here, the final result is 1. So the amplitude of the 0 state will be 1 in case we're in the constant case. On the other hand, if exactly 1/2 of the xi's is 1 and the other half is 0, then what you're summing over here contains exactly as many 1's as minus 1's, which means that the result, the net result will be 0. Yes?
What was the
O gate you had? So what the O gate, this is its definition here. It basically puts the X, the I bit in the last, in the target. But now since we're using the 0 minus 1 state in the target or output bit, it actually, the bit value will appear in the phase here. And it's a standard trick. Okay, so if we take stock then, doing a final measurement is going to give the 0 state with certainty if we're in the case where the input is constant, and it's going to give any other state, but certainly not the 0 state, in case we're in the balanced, in case we have a balanced input. Which means that from doing the final measurement at the end of the algorithm, we can with certainty infer whether we're in the constant or the balanced case. So we can solve this problem with one quantum query. Is this projector completely focused here? Or not? Looks a bit odd at the bottom. Oh. Okay, so that was one simple example of a quantum black box algorithm which achieves a big speed up compared to classical black box algorithms for the same problem. Now here I have a slide of definitions which I would have put on the second projector if I had one. Since I don't have one, you're going to have to memorize this. So I'm now going to define 4 different complexity measures for computing a function f in this black box model. Two of them will be quantum and two of them will be classical. So let's first define the classical complexities. So I'm going to define d of f, where d stands for deterministic complexity, as the number of black box queries that any deterministic classical algorithm needs to compute f. So for instance, for this Deutsch-Joser problem, d of f would be n over 2 plus 1. And I'm going to define r sub 2 of f as the number of queries that the classical bounded error algorithm needs to compute f with a small error probability, which by convention we can put at 1/3. You can also put it at 1,000th or something, because it's a standard trick in complexity theory that if you have an algorithm with a small error probability and you repeat it k times, then basically the error probability goes down exponentially in k. So you can very quickly reduce this error 1/3 to any very small value that you want, only changing the complexity by a small constant factor. So d of f is the deterministic complexity, and r sub 2 of f is the bounded error complexity of computing f. The subscript 2 here indicates two-sided error. So both on zero inputs and on one inputs, the algorithm can err. I guess you can just forget about this 2 here. It's not so very important. Now, in order to define the quantum analogs of this thing, I will have to give a general definition of what it means, of what a quantum query algorithm is. So in general, I will define a T-query quantum algorithm as something of this form here. So this is something in the circuit model. Time progresses from left to right. Initially, we have a bunch of qubits, let's say m of them, which are all initialized at the classical zero state. Sorry? Yeah, it's probably good. Okay, so there are two classical complexities, deterministic complexity and bounded error complexity. And given this definition of what a T-query quantum algorithm looks like, I will define two quantum analogs of that. So let's briefly look at the definition of a T-query quantum algorithm. You start out with a number of qubits, a lot of them. In fact, we're not counting for the input for the number of qubits here, so you can use as many as you want, as much workspace as you want. They all are initialized in a zero state. Then you apply some fixed unitary transformation to the input state, a unitary transformation which does not depend on the input x. Then you apply your first query, which does depend on x. So this O thing here will in some way contain the input x. Yes?
Why do you have the subscript 2 for the probabilistic
one? It refers to two-sided bounded error. So there are also one-sided. This is like Las Vegas versus Monte Carlo. It probably would have been better to omit it here, but... Well, I'll just leave it in anyway. A T-query quantum algorithm starts out in a fixed classical state. It applies a fixed unitary transformation, which you can think of as being built up by your usual quantum gates, Hadamard, phase rotations, controlled knots, and God knows what. Then you apply a first query. So this O thing here is going to allow you to access the inputs in superposition or in any way that you want. Then you apply another fixed unitary transformation, U1, which again does not depend on the input, and so on for T steps. So in total, you will have T applications of this O black box here, and T plus 1 unitary transformations, which do not depend on the input. And at the end, you're going to have some big superposition where you just measure one dedicated qubit, let's say the top one, and that's going to give you 0 or 1, and that's going to be the output of your quantum algorithm. Now, let me emphasize that this thing here, this definition of a T-query algorithm, is really the most general thing you can do with T-queries on a quantum computer. The reason being that if you have some other query algorithm where the queries are sort of are not lined up in a nice way like this, you can easily transform it by rearranging things to get something of this form without changing the number of queries. Also, I'm assuming that there are no intermediate measurements in this algorithm, which, again, is without loss of generality. It's not going to increase the number of queries if we postpone all the measurements until the final one. So this is really the most general thing you can do with the queries on a quantum computer. Now I'm in a position to define the quantum analogs of these two classical complexities. So first, the one without error. I'm going to define Q sub E of F as the number of queries that an exact quantum algorithm needs. So this subscript capital E here stands for exact, by which I mean that there is no error probability on any of the inputs. No matter which inputs is contained in O, your algorithm should always give the right output with probability 1. But of course, we can also allow a little probability of error, just like we did in the classical case. So I'm going to define Q sub T of F. That's the same Q sub 2 of F. That's the same sub 2 for for two-sided bounded error as the number of queries that a bounded error quantum algorithm needs. And again, let's assume that we allow error probability at most 1/3 on any input. Well, since I now have two projectors, I'm going to leave this thing here for future reference. Okay, so why is this an interesting model? Why should we care about this stuff? Classically speaking, we're just dealing with decision tree complexity here. If you're a computer scientist, you've probably heard of decision tree complexity. So this is what it is. This is just the deterministic and randomized decision tree complexity of your function f. Now, the reason why the black box model or this query complexity model is interesting is that virtually all known quantum algorithms can be cast in this model or work in this model in some sense. Okay, I'm slightly out of balance here, which will probably mean that at some point I tumble from the stage, but we'll see that when it happens. So, like I said, most quantum algorithms actually work in this query complexity model in some way or other. We've already seen the example of the Deutsch-Jose algorithm, which was the first sort of non-trivial quantum algorithm, and it fits very nicely in this model. So the classical complexity of the Deutsch-Jose problem was n over 2 plus 1, and the quantum query complexity for an exact algorithm was just 1. That's just the example that I showed you some slides ago. Now, the Deutsch-Jose algorithm is interesting for several reasons. One, for historical reasons. Secondly, because it's easy to explain on two slides. It doesn't really compute something interesting. However, the two main quantum algorithms that do something interesting can also be cast in the black box model. So the first was Shor's period-finding algorithm, or order-finding algorithm, which is basically the quantum part of his vectoring algorithm. Now, suppose we have an input now which consists of a tuple of numbers, all between 1 and n. So we have, say, capital N plus 1 numbers. Each of them can be described by about log n bits. And this thing here describes the periodic function. I've called it m because it derives from modular exponentiation, as maybe you remember from Mike's talk. That's the thing that we want to compute the period of in order to solve the vectoring problem. So there exists some number r, which will be the period such that, whenever you add r to the input of m, you get the same thing. And also, the function m should be 1-to-1 within a period. This is not very important because I just want to use this to illustrate the black box model. Now, the thing is that Shor's algorithm solves the period finding problem on such an input using order 1 queries to m. Notice that m is now no longer a bit, but a small number, about log capital M bits, but that's about the same thing. So you can solve the period finding problem if you state it in the query complexity fashion. You can solve it using only order 1, a constant number of queries, whereas classically, I think Richard Kleeft showed that you need a very large number, something like capital N to the 1/3. There could be some log factors here, which I haven't written because I haven't looked them up. In any case, the main thing is that this period finding problem can be written in a query complexity fashion, and it gives a very strong quantum classical separation, order 1 versus polynomial in capital N. Now, the second quantum algorithm that does something really interesting is Grover's algorithm, which basically searches a space of n bits. So in this case, we have x being capital N bits, and we want to find some position I such that the ith bit is 1. And you can view this as an abstraction of a database search problem. And you can also use it to solve NP-complete problems quadratically faster than the naive brute force approach. And in this case, Grover's algorithm solves the search problem with about square root of n queries. It has small error probability, so I've put a subscript 2 here. And it's easy to show that the classical search problem takes about n steps because there's nothing better than just linearly going through the database until you find the one, which takes n steps in the worst case. So these are some prime examples of quantum algorithms. They all can be cast in the query complexity model. And the same holds for Simon's algorithm for counting complexity, for the binary search or ordered search algorithms, the collision problem, element distinctness problem, and so on. Virtually all of the quantum algorithms that are known in some way or other work in the black box model and achieve a provable speed up there in terms of number of queries. Now, for reasons of fairness, I guess I should also mention a few areas which do not fit well in the black box model. And examples here are communication complexity and finite automata. Though I should mention that most of the quantum communication complexity protocols are actually derived from quantum black box algorithms. So looking at this list, it seems that the black box model captures a significant part of the power of quantum computing. And therefore, it's interesting to look at the limitations of quantum computers in this model. So limitations on the number of queries that a quantum algorithm needs to solve a specific problem. And that's what my talk is about. So let me briefly mention two early lower bounds approaches dating from before Shor's algorithm. So this is really ancient history. The first one, I guess really the first approach was Richard Joza, who in, I think, 1991 examined the power of one quantum query. So if you just restrict your quantum algorithm to one query, what sort of problems can you solve? Of course, we've seen that you can solve the Deutsch-Joza algorithm, the Deutsch-Joza problem with only one quantum query. And what else could you do? And Joza basically showed that you could not do much more than that. But this is very limited, of course, because it just considers the one query case. Then, very interestingly was the research by Bennett, Bernstein, Brassard, and Fazirani. I guess this research probably dates from around 1993, but it was only published in 1997. And they proved the square root lower bounds on the quantum complexity of the search problem, which matches Grover's algorithm, but actually predates it. So that's somewhat surprising. Very briefly, the way they prove this is the following idea. It's called the hybrid method. So take any quantum search algorithm and see what it does on an empty database, so where all of the input bits are zero. So suppose you have some T-query quantum search algorithm, which searches well. Let's see what it does on the zero input. Now, they basically showed via some rewriting and the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality that if you have T queries, then there can be at most T squared variables in this input which can influence the output. All the other variables will receive too little amplitude on them to have any significance for the outcome. So at most T squared of the variables in the input here can be relevant, can be significant for the output. But notice that if you change any of these capital M bits, then the output, the proper output of the search problem changes. So the number of variables that are able to influence the outcome should be N. Now since there are at most T squared of them, we get this lower bound, which implies that T is at least square root of N. And I've omitted a few small constant factors here so as sort of to keep things readable. Now the first generally applicable lower bound method that I want to discuss is called the polynomial method. I should mention maybe that the term polynomial here has nothing to do with the term polynomial in polynomial time, like P, BPP, and that sort of stuff. It's really an algebraic thing here that we use as a tool to analyze algorithms and functions. So again, we have some Boolean function f that we want to compute. It acts on capital M bits, and it has only one bit as output. And now let's say we have some polynomial P, which acts on capital N real variables and outputs a real variable. So this is a multivariate, an n-variate polynomial. And I'm going to define two notions which relate these polynomials and these functions. So I'm going to say that the polynomial P represents the function f if fx equals P of x for all Boolean inputs x. Now, this P thing here is a real-valued polynomial, so you could basically input anything into it. But if you input an n-bit vector x, then you should get the same value as what you get when you input x into the Boolean function f. So if you look at it for 1 minute, I think this is fairly obvious. P represents f if it's just equal to f on all on the Boolean cube. And let's define the degree of f as the minimum degree among all its representing polynomials p. I'm going to give an example in a second. But apart from representing f, we can also settle for just approximating f. So we say that the polynomial p, this n-variate polynomial p, approximates our n-variate function f if fx and px are very close for all Boolean inputs. Let's say they are at most one-third for all Boolean x. And let's define the approximate degree. So this twiddle here is going to define approximate degree. Let's define the define the approximate degree of f as the minimum degree among all approximating polynomials of f. So a very small example, suppose we have the OR function on just two variables. So the OR function is 1 if at least one of its two inputs is 1. Here's a simple degree 2 polynomial that represents the OR function. If all the variables are 0, then you can see that this polynomial is 0, as it should be. And if at least one of the two variables is 1, then this polynomial also takes on value 1, as it should. So this degree 2 polynomial here represents the OR. And in fact, this is the only polynomial that represents the OR function on two variables, which shows that the degree of the OR function on two variables is 2, because this term here has degree 2. However, sometimes an approximating polynomial can do with a smaller degree. For instance, here's a degree 1 polynomial, which approximates the OR. If you just take 2/3 of times the first variable plus 2/3 times the second variable, then you get something which has only degree 1 and which still approximates the OR. This function here is going to be close to the OR function, that is at most 1/3 away on all four possible Boolean inputs. So this shows that the approximate degree of the OR function is only 1 if you look at two variables. A last comment before I continue to the lower bounds. It suffices here to consider only multilinear polynomials. So notice that these things don't have higher exponents here, like x to the power 3 or something. The reason is that if you only care about the values of the polynomial on Boolean inputs, then you can just drop all the degrees, because x squared will be x if x is just 0 or 1. So I can just restrict attention to multilinear polynomials here. And in the coming slides, if I will use the word polynomial, you should just sort of insert the word multilinear there. So these are just some definitions and examples. Now, the good thing is that these degrees actually provide very strong lower bounds on quantum query complexity. In particular, the degree of f divided by 2 gives you a lower bound on the number of queries that any exact quantum algorithm needs to compute f. And similarly, the approximate degree divided by 2 gives you a lower bound on the query complexity of bounded error quantum algorithms, which means that you can basically study quantum query complexity by studying degrees of polynomials. So we reduce the lower bound question to a basic algebraic question. And since algebra has existed quite a bit longer than quantum computing, it gives us lots of tools which we can now apply to the new field of quantum computing. And I'm going to prove these two results in the next two slides. They're not extremely hard to prove. So the crucial observation is to note that while the state in this T query algorithm is evolving, you can represent the amplitudes of all the basis states by polynomials. And the degree of the polynomial will grow slowly in the network. In particular, after T queries, you can represent all of the amplitudes of all the basis states by polynomials, in fact, complex-valued polynomials of degree at most T. And I'm going to prove that on this slide. So in general, the final state of our algorithm, so the superposition that sits here, that final state after T queries is going to depend on x in the following way. So phi, which is the final state on input x, will be a superposition over all m qubit basis states, assuming we have m qubits here. We have 2 to the m basis states. Each of them has an amplitude which will be a function of x, because x comes in via these applications of O. I mean, the final amplitudes will depend on the contents of this black box here. Like I said, the crucial thing is that these functions alpha sub k of x, notice that these are n-variant functions, these are actually low-degree polynomials. They're polynomials of degree, at most, the number of queries that you've used in your algorithm. And here's the proof. It's basically by induction on the number of queries. Now, initially, you start out with a fixed state here, which means that the amplitudes in the initial state will not depend on the input at all. They will be constants, and the constants are also known as polynomials of degree 0. Then to the initial state, you apply some unitary transformation U0, which brings you to this point in the algorithm, basically. But notice that a fixed unitary transformation applied to a fixed vector will just give you another fixed constant vector. So again, the amplitudes at this point will just be polynomials of degree 0. They will be constants independent of the inputs. And now we're at the point where we apply our first query, the first application of this black box O. Now, notice what O does. The only thing that it does is it permutes the states I, 0 and I, 1 in case xi equals 1. And it doesn't do anything to these two states in case xi equals 0. Because this bit is going to contain xi. This bit is going to contain the negation of xi, which means if xi is 0, then nothing happens. And if xi is 1, then these two states get swapped, or rather their amplitudes get swapped. And the same happens for all different i's, for all I, 0, I, 1 pairs, but I will just analyze one pair, because by linearity everything works also for the general superposition. So suppose we are here. We have now amplitudes of the basis states, which are constants, degree 0 polynomials. Now we apply our first query. So suppose at this point the amplitude of the I, 0 state is alpha and the amplitude of the I, 1 state is beta. Then since O just permutes these two things depending on the value of xi, you can actually write the new amplitudes of these two basis states as these functions here. And this is just a complicated way of saying that the amplitude remains alpha if xi is 0, and the amplitude of this state here becomes beta if xi is 1. But notice that these functions here, since alpha and beta were constants, these functions here are now degree 1 polynomials in the input variables. And only degree 1. And more generally, if at some point these alpha and beta are polynomials of degree k, then these new functions here, these new amplitudes, they will be polynomials of degree at most k plus 1. Which means that if you view these things here as polynomials of a certain degree, then a next query can only increase that degree by 1. It may even decrease it, but it can only increase it by 1. Now, after a query, you get another unitary transformation. But since this is a linear transformation independent of the input, the way it transforms the amplitudes will just be it takes linear sums of the old amplitudes, and a linear sum of degree k polynomials will still be a degree k polynomial. So the amplitudes after the uj's will have the same degree as before the uj's. And basically, you can see the inductive argument going. Initially, you have degree 0 polynomials. After the first query, you have degree 1 polynomials. U1 doesn't change that. After the second query, you have degree 2 polynomials, and so on. So after the final state here can now be written, the amplitudes in the final state can now be written as polynomials of degree at most t, where t was the total number of queries you've used. And now, what does this mean for the outputs of the function? So remember that we obtain the outputs, the output of the algorithm, by measuring one dedicated qubit of the final state. Let's just say the first one. That means that the probability of outputting one, given a certain final superposition, is just the sum of the squares of the amplitudes of all the basis states k, starting with the one, because those are the ones giving rise to output one. So the probability of outputting 1 can be written in this form here. It's a sum of squares of a set of amplitudes. Now, since these amplitudes here, these functions alpha sub k of x, are multivariate, multilinear polynomials of degree at most t, if you square them and sum them, you're going to get a polynomial of degree at most 2t, which means that p of x, this probability of outputting 1, is a polynomial of degree at most 2t, where, again, to repeat, t is the number of queries that you've used. But now, another crucial observation is that if your algorithm is actually exact, if it computes the function f exactly, then the probability of outputting 1 should be 1 if the function is 1, and the probability of outputting 1 should be 0 if the function is 0. So what you get, in effect, is that this acceptance probability px here must equal f of x for all Boolean inputs. And that, in turn, implies that the degree of p, the degree of this unknown acceptance probability, which is upper bounded by 2t, is lower bounded by the degree of f, because we define the degree of f as the minimal degree among all polynomials p that represent f. So we basically get this lower bound here, which I promised to show you, and which I have, I think, completely proven. So the degree of f divided by 2 is a lower bound on the exact query complexity of quantum algorithms. And you could do something very similar for bounded error algorithms. So for a bounded error algorithm, again, the acceptance probability will be a low degree polynomial. And now this acceptance probability must be at least 2/3 if your function is 1, and it must be at most 1/3 if your function is 0. So in the approximate case, p of x will be close to f of x, so we get a low degree approximating polynomial for f, which by the same reasoning will imply this lower bound here. The approximate degree of f divided by 2 lower bounds quantum query complexity, even for bounded error quantum algorithms. Okay, some applications, some examples of what you can get using polynomials. Well, let's consider the OR function. So the OR function is basically to decide whether there's at least one 1 in your n-bit input vector. And notice that this is very much related to database search, because if you can search for a 1, if you can find a 1, you can also decide the OR function, obviously. If you can find a 1, you can decide if there is at least one 1. Now, notice that the degree of the OR function, if you write it out, it will turn out to be maximal. There's a monomial in this polynomial that has full degree, so the degree of OR will be capital N. And by our lower bounds, this will imply that the exact complexity of a quantum algorithm that computes the OR exactly must be at least N divided by 2. And in particular, this implies that for the search problem, if you don't want any error probability, if you want to have an exact algorithm, this also takes you at least N over 2 steps. So Grover's algorithm searches a database in square root N steps with a small probability of error. If you want to get rid of this probability of error, you lose the quantum advantage. And in fact, this N over 2 can be improved to N by a slightly different argument, also polynomial based. So there's no speed up whatsoever if you want your quantum search to be without any error probability. That's one example. Now for the bounded error case for the OR function, you can actually show that the approximate degree of the OR function is square root of N, which gives us the square root of N lower bounds on Grover's algorithm. So it rederives the Bennett-Bernstein-Brassard-Fasirani lower bound on Grover search in a very different way. As another example, an example where you don't get any speed up even if you allow bounded error probability, the parity function, so that's basically the function which is 1 if the number of 1s in the input is odd, and which is 0 if the number of 1s in the input is even. So it's the parity of the n-bit vector that you get as input. Now, it's not so hard to show that this thing has approximate degree, which is maximal, again, n, which means that in order to compute the parity function, even a bounded error quantum algorithm needs a lot of queries. It needs n over 2 queries. So there's no significant speed up for parity compared to classical computation. And this was shown independently around the same time via a different proof by Fari, Goldstone, Goodman, and Sipser. And in fact, what's true for parity is true for most functions. Almost all functions f on n variables have almost maximal degree. This was shown by Ambinus. What this means is that the fraction of Boolean functions with very low degree is very small. It goes to 0 when n increases, which means that for most Boolean functions, there's no significant speed up compared to classical computation. So what this result says in words is that the functions for which a quantum computer is useful are very sparse. We've seen Shor's algorithm, we've seen Grover's algorithm. These are really exceptional cases. For most functions f in the query complexity setting, there's hardly any speed up to be obtained by a quantum computer. Of course, this does not mean in any way, by no means, that a quantum computer is useless, because, there may be many, many problems which are outside of this set. I mean, most problems are hard, but most problems are not even interesting. So don't let this deter you from entering the field. Now, on the previous slide, I've shown some examples for specific functions like OR and parity. You can, in fact, prove a general result using the polynomial approach. And that is the result that if you have a total function, meaning a function that is defined on all 2 to the n Boolean inputs, then the classical and the query complexity are actually very close. They're polynomially related. Very sketchily, the way this proof goes is it uses the notion of block sensitivity, which I won't explain, but let me say that block sensitivity is a measure of how sensitive your function is to changes in its input. So if the block sensitivity is high, that means that there are many places in an input where you can change your function to change the output value. And I'm going to denote block sensitivity of a function f by bs of f. Now, it was shown by Nissan and Segedi in 1994 that the square root of the block sensitivity gives you a lower bound on the approximate degree of a function. And we showed in our paper that introduced, so this is Beals, Berman, Cleave, Mosca, and myself, in 98, where we introduced this stuff to quantum computing. We showed that the block sensitivity to the power 3 is an upper bound on the classical deterministic theory complexity. Now, combining these two facts with the fact that this thing here is a lower bound on the bounded error quantum theory complexity, we actually get this result here. And I've omitted the constant factor here because I don't want to write it down. It's about 4,000. So what this says here in words is that for all total functions in the black box model, quantum bounded error computation is at most polynomially better than classical deterministic computation. So let's consider what sort of speedups we have. On the one hand, we have exponential speedups like for Simon's algorithm and for Shor's period finding algorithm. All of these things are promise problems. The input must have a very specific form, like being periodic, in order for the quantum algorithm to work. On the other hand, we have total functions like the database search problem or the OR problem, where we get a quadratic speedup from Grover's algorithm. This result says that you cannot combine these two features. There is no total function where you can achieve an exponential speedup. Okay, that's the last slide, I guess, for the polynomial method. Any questions at this point? Then I will go on to the second general method. So the second method was introduced by Andris Ambainis about 1.5 years ago. And it's called the quantum adversary method. Let me briefly give you the intuition of the method. So suppose we have some algorithm A. Ignore the quantum classical difference for now. Just consider any algorithm A that computes our function f. Then what this algorithm must do in the course of its computation is distinguish any pair of inputs x and y that have different f values, that have different output values. Because suppose your algorithm A, in the course of its computation, does not distinguish between x and y, and suppose it answers correctly on x, and it's going to give the same output on y, but that's now an incorrect output because fx is different from fy. So your algorithm A will have to distinguish between any x, y that have different output values. And if there are many such pairs, and if these pairs are in some way close together, then this is going to be hard. So that's the basic idea of the method. And some examples, I'm going to explain this in more detail on the next slide, but some examples of bounds that you can get using this adversary method are, well, again, the square root n lower bound for quantum search. This is about, I guess, the 20th proof or so of this result, but it's still interesting. You can get a square root n lower bound for basically searching an AND-OR tree, which is iterated OR AND or AND-OR. And you can get a square root n lower bound for inverting a permutation. And the two last bounds were not known before the quantum adversary method. So the way I'm going to present this method is slightly different from the way Ambainis introduced it. I'm following the presentation of Hoyer, Nierbeck, and Shi. And that's summarized on this slide here. And on the next slide, I will show for the search problem how this works in more specific detail. So let capital X and capital Y be sets of inputs such that whenever you take an X from capital X and an input Y from capital Y, then the pair has different output values. And some notation here, let psi sub X to the superscript J be the state of our algorithm, so fix some T query algorithm for F. Let this state psi sub X super J be the state of our algorithm after J queries if the input is X, if the black box O contains input X. Then at the end of the algorithm, our quantum algorithm must be able to distinguish X from Y because they have different output values. In terms of linear algebra, what this means is that after T queries, the state psi in case of input X and the state psi after input Y must be far apart. They must be almost orthogonal. And for the sake of argument, let's say that the inner product is at most 1/2. I'm just choosing this value here for convenience. The main point is that it's strictly less than 1. And if this condition would not hold, then a quantum algorithm cannot distinguish between X and Y, which it should because X and Y have different output values. And another piece of notation, let's define Wj as the sum over all of these inner products for all XY pairs after the jth query. So, well, just very briefly parse this definition here. So it's just a sum over all of these inner products. Now, initially, of course, if you have done zero queries, your state does not depend on the input at all. So, which means that for j equals zero, this inner product will just be one, because this state will be equal to this state. Since you're summing over x times y many pairs, initially, before you start a computation, w0 will be the size of x times the size of y. That's sort of obvious, because all of these inner products here are one. Now, at the end of the computation, after t queries, each of these inner products must have shrunk from one to at most a half, which means that the total sum of them must be at most one half times the size of x times the size of y, because this is the number of pairs. So in the course of the computation, what the algorithm must do, it must basically drive down this sum significantly. It must go down from x times y to at most one half x times y. Now, if we can show that in one query, it cannot drive down this sum very much, then it's actually going to need a lot of queries. If you want to go down from a high point to a low point and you can only take very small steps, then you're going to need a lot of steps. Slightly more formally, if we can show that the difference, so the decrease in this sum wj minus wj plus 1 is at most b for every j, for every next query, then the lower bounds that you get on your quantum query complexity will be the amount by which the sum must go down divided by the amount by which it can go down in one step, which will be this. Now, this is a general method, and of course the proof of the pudding is in the eating, which means that the crucial thing is to prove a good failure for B here, depending on the problem you want to prove a lower bound for. And one simple example where it works well is the search problem. By the way, my slides are reproduced in the booklet, so there's no need to write anything down. So the instantiations of the sets capital X and capital Y to get a lower bound for the search problem are very simple. The set X will just consist of one input, which will basically be the empty database, and the set Y will consist of n inputs, which are basically all the inputs having 1, 1 somewhere at some position I. So I ranges from 1 up to n here, and by E sub I, I mean the Boolean vector that just has 1, 1, and this 1 is at position I. Now, to repeat from the previous slide, we have this quantity here, the sum over all pairs of this inner product here. And initially, of course, again, this inner product will be 1 for every pair, which means that W0 at the beginning of the algorithm is the size of X times the size of Y. That's the number of pairs, which in this case is 1 times N equals N. At the end of the computation, because all of the inner products must go down to at most a half, the sum WT must be at most one half this thing, which is N over 2. So in the course of the computation in T queries, this quantity here must lose at least N over 2 of its value. Now, Unbinus was able to show that in one step it can lose at most square root of N of its value. And this immediately implies that you need a lot of steps, namely about square root of N of them. If you want to lose N over 2 in total value, and you lose only square root of n in each step, then you're going to need square root of n divided by two steps. And again, I've been a little bit fuzzy about the constants. There's probably a small constant here that I don't care to write, because there's not much intuition added by adding it on the slide. The main thing are the asymptotic lower bounds of square root of n for search. Well, this concludes the question. Yes? Well, notice that what we're actually comparing here are runs of the same algorithm on different inputs. So here we're comparing the state after j queries if the input is x, and here we're comparing the state after j queries if the input is y. Now, the difference between x and y shows up in the application of O. I mean, if O contains the input x, then it's going to have some different, it's going to be a different unitary matrix than when it contains y, which means that the final superpositions will also be different. So I guess that's a good point, which maybe I should emphasize. The only point in this T query algorithm where the input shows up is in the black box, the application of O. And this makes a difference, and this forces the algorithm to slowly drive away the inputs corresponding to different outputs. I guess that answers the question. Okay. Well, this concludes. I'm almost at the end of the talk and almost at the end of the time. Just two more slides. Let me briefly